Local Talk on KHOI's Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Mike Metz, your co-host today, along with Sam Wormley. Thank you for listening in. Hello, Sam. How are you doing?
Well, hello, Mike. It's good to hear your voice.
Okay. Hey, before we start, let's visit in. Let's have Dennis Hart give his wrap-up of this week's news.
It's really good to be back here on this Friday. There was plenty of news to report this past week, starting with Saturday, when there was a story about the Ames retail outlets that had recently purchased a device called Caroline's Cart, a device that provides caregivers an option to transport a special needs person through a store without having to maneuver a wheelchair and a traditional shopping cart at the same time. The device is named after a young woman whose parents designed it. The cart's handles swing upward to provide easy access to the seat. And there was word that two nonprofit organizations in Ames had finished first and second in a contest known as Make My Nonprofit Run Better. The contest is run by an Iowa-based technology business. The local nonprofit winners were the Ames Cyclone Aquatics Club and Actors Incorporated. The Aquatics Club won a $15,000 prize to be used for an office technology makeover. Actors earned $5,000. Sunday brought word about Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagg and Ducks Unlimited CEO Adam Putnam, who toured one of Story County's newest conservation projects. It's a nearly 12-acre wetland pool near Collins that was constructed as part of the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, and it's the first of four locations scheduled to be completed this year, using $80,000 from an agreement with Ducks Unlimited. The other three wetland sites are under construction in Hardin, Buena Vista, and Carroll counties. The program provides incentives to landowners, usually farmers and ranchers, who establish wetlands on their property for water quality improvement. Owners receive 15 years of annual rent payments for all enrolled acres from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Also Sunday, word that more than 500 people donated money or braved chilly weather last Saturday to take part in the annual Walk to End Alzheimer's event in Ames. It was a two-mile trek in temperatures that barely reached the 40s. Nearly 60 teams took part in fundraising for the event. There was more last Sunday, including a story about this year's upcoming Spirits in the Gardens event at Ryman Gardens. It will take place tomorrow and Sunday night, and organizers hope to have about 1,000 carved pumpkins all lit up and ready to view. Hundreds of volunteers work to stencil each pumpkin and carve them out. The event will take place from 4 to 10 p.m. tomorrow and from 4 to 9 p.m. on Sunday. And there was another preview story, this one about an event that will take place on Sunday, October 27th here in Ames. That's the date of a big celebration to commemorate several anniversaries involving the carillon, which is the musical instrument inside Iowa State University's iconic campanile, and also involving the 50th birthday of Stevens Auditorium. An anniversary concert will take place at Stevens on Sunday afternoon, October 27th, at 3 o'clock. And, of course, the sports pages last Sunday featured plenty of stories about Iowa State University's 38-14 victory over West Virginia in a Big 12 conference football game on Saturday. The Cyclones now have 2 wins and 1 loss in conference play, and they're 4-2 overall this season. Tomorrow, Iowa State plays Texas Tech in Texas. Tuesday brought word that Democratic presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren, who is the frontrunner in most polls, would be coming to Ames this coming Monday night. She will appear at Stevens Auditorium at the Iowa State Center. Also Tuesday, word that a man who fired gunshots into an apartment in Huxley last spring had been sentenced to 25 years in prison. 22-year-old Montrell McClellan had been found guilty of robbery and assault, among other charges. Three others charged in connection with the incident had all reached plea agreements and had testified against McClellan in court. Authorities said no one had been injured in the shooting incident. There was more on Tuesday, including a report on a global seed symposium that was held at Iowa State University on Monday. It was held in conjunction with a World Food Prize in Des Moines. The theme of each session on Monday focused on an award-winning documentary film called Seeds, Diversity of Wonder, which follows the tale of seeds through such countries as India and Africa, as well as through farms here in Iowa. Iowa State University President Wendy Winterstein spoke at the symposium, saying that the biggest public testing laboratory for seeds in the world is at ISU. In a related event, Winterstein held a public conversation with this year's World Food Prize laureate, Simon Groot, on Monday evening in the Great Hall of Iowa State University's Memorial Union. Groot founded East West Seed in 1982, the first market-oriented vegetable seed brewing company to serve small farms as a main client base. He said the struggle was to get farmers to understand that seeds with higher qualities were good for them and not just an extra burden on their finances. He told Winterstein and a big audience at the Memorial Union that the world is waiting for young people who can play a role in advancing the improvement of seeds. There was also word that for the second straight year, the Ames Minor Hockey Association would host a try hockey for free tomorrow. There will be two sessions at the ice arena, one at 11:45 tomorrow morning, the other at 1:30 in the afternoon. Skates, sticks, pucks, and helmets will be provided. Each participant in the events will have a partner or lead skater with them to assure safety. Volunteers will consist of parents, coaches, and local high school hockey players. All this in an effort to expand the sport of hockey in central Iowa. Wednesday brought word that the trial of an Ames man accused of tearing down and burning an LGBTQ pride banner in June had been delayed for 2 weeks. 30-year-old Adolfo Martinez was supposed to go on trial this past Tuesday, but because of a shortage of available judges in Story County, it's been delayed to October 29th. Martinez is charged with third-degree arson, a hate crime, in connection with an incident in which he allegedly burned a flag from the United Church of Christ. Authorities said he admitted ripping down the flag and setting it on fire. Also Wednesday, a report that corn harvesting in Iowa is about 2 weeks behind last year and 10 days behind average. 65% of the corn crop is rated good to excellent, but only 3% had been harvested. Meanwhile, soybean harvesting is 12 days behind average. 64% of that crop is rated good to excellent, with 5% of soybeans having been harvested. Wednesday's paper also reported that the Story County Board of Supervisors had adopted a timeline for its 2021 to 2025 capital improvement plan. Final approval of that plan is set for next March. The county's capital improvements plan is a document that details construction improvements and acquisitions. And one more note from Wednesday, word that the Mandarin Chinese restaurant at 415 Lincoln Way in Ames will close its doors for good on November 3rd, after 37 years in business. The building has been sold to a real estate firm, and the property it's on is part of a potential multi-use development project that may take place on that part of Lincoln Way. Properties that had Taco Time, KFC, Harris Appliance, and the current Starbucks location are all involved in potential plans for the multi-use development. The Taco Time, KFC, and Harris Appliance buildings have all been demolished. No demolition date has been set for Mandarin's building. The restaurant's owner said there's a chance it could reopen in a different location, but it would have to be a perfect spot. Two more notes from Wednesday. The First United Methodist Church Women's Annual Holiday Fair will take place tomorrow morning starting at 8 at the church on Kellogg Avenue in Ames. And Amnesty International will meet tomorrow afternoon at the Ames Public Library. Discussion will revolve around human rights issues, and letters will be written on behalf of individuals whose human rights have been violated. That meeting will take place from 1 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Thursday, yesterday, brought word about the rally held Wednesday night by Democratic presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg in the Sheeman Building at the Iowa State Center. About 900 people turned out to hear the South Bend mayor talk about a wide variety of issues, including gun control. He told the crowd that banning assault rifles and high-capacity magazines would be priorities in his administration. He also discussed health care and climate change solutions. Also Thursday, a report that the community of Huxley would soon have a new city administrator. She is Rita Connor, who now serves as Economic Development Director for Des Moines. Connor will assume her role December 16th, replacing outgoing City Administrator John Haldeman. Haldeman said, among his greatest achievements, witnessing the arrival of a Fairway store on U.S. Highway 69 on the city's north side, and working with the school district to improve local schools. Also Thursday, word that a group known as Better Angels, which seeks to unite Democrats and Republicans, will show the organization's documentary on Monday, October 28th, at the Ames Library at 6:30 p.m. The film is called Reuniting America, the story of a group consisting of 8 Democrats and 7 Republicans taking part in a workshop in which both sides experience skepticism followed by empathy. Better Angel started in 2016. And there you have it, your summary of the week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart, planning to take the weekend off now, but promising to return to this very seat on Monday, when I'll take a look at what's been making news around the state of Iowa. Between now and then, go ahead. Have a great weekend.
And thank you, Dennis. I'm sure he's enjoying the warm weather out California way, where he is now residing for the next couple of months. And in honor of Dennis and Ursula, usually this time of week, Sam, they talk about wild ones. And I've got just a little story that I want to share with our listeners. And feel free to pipe in if you want to, because I know you've been in on my prairie before. But I was out walking the dog, and we ran across a couple of salamanders. And I was asked by one of the individuals walking with me, why are they out here this time of year? And those little guys are trying to find their way back from the fields to the wetlands to spend their winter. As we were walking, we also came across a couple of crayfish. And I know you really like the crayfish when you've been out there.
Oh, I like the crayfish. I like the holes that they're down in. And one time when I was on the internet looking things up, I thought, gosh, these are related to the crabs. And so they're really in the category of freshwater crabs, these little guys.
Right. So what have you been up to lately, Sam?
Up to? Wow. Well, a friend of mine driving this morning noticed that Orion, the constellation in the southern skies, was his guide to find his way.
And you would know something about Orion and the constellations.
I would indeed. And I noticed when I walked out of the house, there was a really nice moon. It's just a few days past full, and it's nice and bright. And I can imagine nighttime hunters could take advantage of this moon.
That's something that kind of shines a light on one of the programs that we co-host. I'm sorry, Sam.
Would that be Science Bites?
That would be Science Bites, Sam. Can you share with the listeners a little bit about the program that we host on Tuesdays on KHOI-FM?
Science Bites is a science program. It's a half hour in length and airs on Tuesday afternoons at 4:30. Mike and I co-host that, and we interview various people that work in the sciences, have experiences in the sciences. But the primary reason we're doing this show is because we want to share our enthusiasm about all sciences with KHOI listeners.
I also want to let the listeners know that we're trying a bit of an experiment. There's a science program Friday afternoons from 4 to 5. It's distributed Pacifica Radio, and it's called Big Picture Science. And there's a little bit of time at the end, and we're trying an experiment called a mini bite, which is a electronic version, a little bit of a steal from our Science Bites program. We're going to see how that goes, and hopefully the listeners will let us know whether they find value in that or not.
Right. And speaking of letting us know, would be wonderful to hear from all the listeners. All they have to do is go to khoifm.org, and they can leave a message, leave comments, and we would love to hear from you.
Sam, why don't we talk a little bit about the science community in Ames, since that's one of the things that we like to try to share with our listeners. Maybe we need to take a little bit of time to voice our concerns and maybe some of the opportunities that folks have here in the community.
I'm trying to think what those science communities are. Obviously, we have a lot of sciences at Iowa State University.
Okay.
And there are obviously scientists working for the Iowa DOT and other industries and organizations in our local area. I know at our church we have a science discussion group that meets twice weekly. There are people that are gathering. There's a climate science team, which is looking at the issues of the changing climate and what we might do to advise our local governments. There's science programs in the schools, science programs brought into the community that are nationwide science contests for school kids, that kind of thing. Is that what you had in mind,
Mike?
That's
what I had in mind. And I know that you and I and a few other folks here from KHOI attended the climate strike that was recently held at our city hall. Could you give me your impression of your feelings of what you experienced there?
The demographics of the 200 to 300 people that showed up were school kids, middle school and high school kids. There was another great faction from Iowa State University, Iowa State University students. Middle-aged people, probably parents and teachers. And there were a lot of older folks, too, people that like to take OLLI courses at Iowa State University. OLLI stands for the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Iowa State. And we saw lots of folks that participate in that program there. So the interest, the spectrum of people interested in climate issues ranges from very young to very old.
That OLLI program that you're talking about, is that something like school? I mean, do you have to take tests and get a grade?
The OLLI program is one of 219 around the country. They're always associated with universities or sometimes community colleges. The point of the OLLI program is to provide people 50 and older with continuing education. And that education can be in the form of lectures or hands-on involvement, covering the sciences and the arts and literature and medicine and how the brain works and all of these things. They don't have to take any tests. They come and engage in the discussions in the classes, and there isn't even a grade, even though I teach a few of those classes and I tell the people that sit up front that they'll definitely get an A.
Get an A. It's not like attending church where some of us would tend to sit in the back. No, I've attended some of those courses as well, and I've found them very helpful and extremely interesting. And the discussion that arises during those courses is very stimulating for not only me but the other participants. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other opportunities for folks. A group that I think about, and you've had some experience with, at least in the past, is the Ames Area Amateur Astronomers group. That's another group of science-minded folks. Do you have any information you could share about that group?
Around Iowa, there are a number of amateur astronomy groups, and sometimes they collaborate, sometimes they share information. Ames has a very healthy, vibrant community of amateur astronomers. They help each other with observing. They help each other learn about telescopes. They help each other in terms of providing information about what's happening in the sky, double stars, some of the research that's going on. Those folks will distill that into something that's a broader nature. In other words, being able to communicate the science of something that's relatively complex and share it with all of the members of the club.
Now, do you recall, can anybody join that club? Do you have to be an astronomer?
I don't think you have to be an astronomer. You just have to be interested in astronomy.
Okay. Are those folks, do some of them share on the side their abilities to have their telescopes out and share maybe some time with other individuals?
Many do, Mike. And when there's a really interesting event in the sky, say a comet is coming in or there'll be a transit of Mercury or Venus across the sun, these folks will tend to set up their telescopes and invite the public. Either out at McFarland Park, the conservation center out there is sort of the headquarters for the Ames Area Amateur Astronomers, or from their homes. In fact, there's invitations over the years to go to this person's house in this little town or whatever and join them to view through the telescope.
I suppose that depends a little bit on the atmospheric conditions and the event that's occurring as to where that location may be.
Of course.
Okay. Yeah, I've attended some of the events out at McFarland, and I would want listeners to know that, yes, that's a pretty interesting setup.
Every year in late summer, early fall, there's an Iowa Star Party. And Iowa Star Party invites people from all over the state to go to a nice dark sky location, usually over in the a little bit to the west of Jefferson, Iowa.
Is that the White Rock Conservancy? Probably?
It is exactly that. And people come there and spend the weekend – commune with each other, share their excitement about what's happening in the sky. In fact, I think they have a regular program of speakers and events so that everybody comes away with having learned something really useful.
Okay. Let's do a little bit of a segue into, we're talking about individuals getting interested in this, and you mentioned that you're an instructor, but you've also taken classes with Ollie. That instills interests in folks, and there are some things that they can do as members of the public. Our listeners can sign up for what's called citizen science projects. Are there any off the top of your head that you can think of? And if not, I can throw a pitch a few your way, and we can talk about those.
One friend of mine spends a lot of his weekends cleaning up rivers in Iowa. That may not be gathering scientific information, but it is certainly thinking in terms of science, cleaning up the environment and making it a better place for all of us.
Okay. I know that there are some programs that I will be highlighting on our Science Bites broadcast here in the near future. We have talked a little bit about some of those, but for example, I've had a recent opportunity to visit with some of the folks out at the Wildlife Resource Center, and also some folks over at the Iowa DNR, some of their programs, specifically things to do where folks can volunteer to help survey for bat populations, frogs and toads, which those poor little guys are probably slipping their long johns on about this time of year. Birds.
Bird counts.
A number of different projects that you don't have to be an expert. You just need to be willing to learn a few techniques and go out and spend time gathering data.
River water sampling.
Right.
Looking for pollutants and runoffs from agricultural practices, looking for bacteria in the water. A friend of ours, Irv Kloss, has done that for many, many decades.
Yes, I've been a part of that as well, only in a different system. There are different sites scattered throughout central Iowa. And go ahead.
Well, this is really not the kind of thing we're talking about. We're talking about going out and doing things contributing to the science, like field work. But people can also contribute to the science with their computers, just by making their computers available to process data, hunting for mathematical solutions or medical solutions, or looking through what we call big data. Big data is large collections of information, and you need lots of computers processing, going through that, using artificial intelligence to pull out of that big data things of interest. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, has had a program for years where people can use in the background on their computers processing that data to help look for ET out there.
Speaking of looking for, if I remember, and maybe you can elaborate on this a little bit, there was a project, and it still may be ongoing, where folks are examining photographs of deep sky areas, studying the lensing effects on planets to see what's going on behind certain objects?
That is a very good possibility. A massive object, it could be the core of a galaxy, it could be a large black hole, it could be a cluster of galaxies, they tend to focus the light from behind around. So we have in the sky these sort of natural microscopes that allow us to see things that are so far away that the light gets amplified on the way here. A lot of those folks that are looking at sky charts, not sky charts, but photographs of the sky, are also looking for stars that are changing in their brightness, looking for variable stars.
Variable stars.
Sometimes the variability of a star is caused by the fact that a planet is orbiting that star. And if the planet comes in front of the star from the perspective of us looking at it, that star dims just a little bit for a period of time. And this is one of the techniques for discovering extraterrestrial planets.
You know, Sam, our listeners right now, if they haven't already visited their restrooms and they're trying to look in the mirror and see how they're doing with the light there, this might be a little bit deep for them, but maybe we need to take just a musical interlude break here for a minute. If you have just joined us, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I am Mike Metz along with my co-host Sam Wormley this morning, and we've been talking about not only our program Science Bites, but a number of other issues, most of which we hope the listeners find interesting. Sam is going to provide just a brief review of some of the subjects that we've covered in the last couple of episodes of Science Bites, and we'll just see where the conversation leads us.
Mike, Science Bites got its start back in January. There was a total lunar eclipse. And for the benefit of our listeners that may not remember what a total lunar eclipse is, it's when the Earth's shadow, the moon passes completely through the Earth's shadow behind the sun.
Right.
And what happens there is that the moon actually takes on a red color, a blood red color. And that's been a sort of a famous circumstance through the centuries where people took advantage of that to say they had great power. I remember Columbus wanted some help from the locals as he came to the New World, and he said, if you don't help me in a couple of days, I'm gonna destroy the moon. And when the eclipse started and it started to turn blood red, the villagers at that time got really scared and pledged to help Columbus.
And that's because they'd already calculated when some of these things were going to occur.
Yes.
So he knew ahead of time.
He knew ahead of time. I mean, you think about it, 1492, when Columbus sailed, they already had pretty good navigational tools and astronomy tables that he knew that the eclipse would occur.
I know one thing that we wanted to emphasize in our program is we try to talk a little bit about our climate here on Earth. We think that's important enough that we try in just about every episode to bring climate as part of the subject matter. I know some folks say, well, that's you always talk about it, but I feel it's extremely important that we keep that on a front burner.
There's a phenomenon called the greenhouse gas effect. If there weren't greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, greenhouse gases are gases that can absorb and re-emit energy, keep it from getting out into space. If we didn't have some greenhouse gases, our planet Earth would be a frozen snowball. The amount of our energy source is the sun, and the sun comes in through the atmosphere, strikes the Earth, warms up the surface, warms up the oceans, and so on. And at night, it radiates back towards space. And if there was nothing to impede that radiation, the Earth would never stay warm. So greenhouse gases are essential for our existence. What's been happening since the Industrial Revolution is just because we've burnt more wood, more coal, more oil, and so on, we're adding to the concentration of those greenhouse gases. If you think about what the concentration has been over billions of years, it's certainly gone up and down because of various geological processes and so on. But right now, what's happening is because of our activity as humans, we're just increasing the level of the concentration of greenhouse gases. The result is the planet is warming. And the warming causes more evaporation of water, causes more energy in the atmosphere, causes more intense storms, things like that, the melting of glaciers, the melting of ice sheets. And so things are changing. And one of the reasons we like to talk about, well, the reason we want to talk about climate on a regular basis is because we want to inform our listeners as to what's happening.
Okay. I see that Alex has arrived from our Ames History Museum, so we'll get him in here and have a visit with him.
Okay. Thank you.
like to welcome Alex Pfeiffer from the Ames History Museum. He's the exhibit manager there. And welcome, Alex. Good to see you. You look pretty chipper.
I don't know. Yeah, out there in radio land, I'm sitting here in my sweatpants.
Okay. Well, Alex, why don't we talk a little bit about the spirited history of alcohol in our fair city?
Oh, yeah. Ames has had a sometimes not so great relationship with alcohol through the years. And this is, Stocky's mentioned Uncorked. That is our current exhibit that we have up down at the Ames History Museum at 5th and Douglas. And we thought with the 100th anniversary of Prohibition coming up, we're kind of in the middle of it right now. They've 100 years ago this summer, they would have ratified it, and it would have gone into effect in January in 1920. So we're getting really close to that 100-year mark of Prohibition getting started here. So we thought, what a great opportunity to talk about our town's history with alcohol and how that is the same as a lot of cities and a lot of states, and how it differs very wildly because of our ties, especially with Iowa State College. But I thought we'd talk about maybe beer permits today and how that all kind of came about right after Prohibition. So maybe you guys enjoy a nice frosty one after a hard day of work every now and then?
That sounds like an opportunity. I know you'd talked about the state liquor stores in the past. But, yeah, I like beer.
Who doesn't like a frosty cold mug there? Well, of course, we had Prohibition lasted from 1920 until 1933. But just before it ended in 33 is actually when FDR, president at the time, signed the 3.2 beer bill. And so that was saying basically that people could sell and produce beer that was under 3.2% alcohol, which if you've ever had a microbrew recently, they are nowhere near that anymore today. They're up in the 5, 6, 7, sometimes 10%. But so that's kind of more your light beer, your side of there. But it was approved. And so, like many cities, they had to go through city councils, had to get beer permits approved. And so Ames was no different. And in fact, they had a very, very eager crowd on beer permit night down at Ames City Council. And basically, the council had no they had to approve them, basically. They had no other option there because they had to abide by the new national law, even though they maybe didn't necessarily want beer and alcohol in their town. But City Clerk A.B. Maxwell agreed, and after the crowd started pleading for them to also approve their permits that night, so they were just approving the process that they'd say, we're going to go ahead and do this. But at that point, 13 dealers had applied for beer permits, too, and begged City Clerk A.B. Maxwell to take them down to his office so that they could get those permits in. And they said in the newspapers, the beer trail followed him all the way down to his office.
So was this, when you're talking about these individuals that applied for this, how did this cover just the individual who maybe wanted to make home brew?
It did not at that time yet. Homebrew laws didn't come until much later, until I believe the Jimmy Carter era is actually when a lot of those started being actually legal to do it. Okay. Not to say people didn't do it, because they sure had 13 years of practice, some of them, producing beer there. But another thing to mention, like I know we talked about state liquor stores last time I was here, if people out there remember that, but the bar atmosphere was not anywhere near like it's today, where you can go in, give me a beer, or give me a Roman Coke, a Manhattan, anything like that. These people that were applying for beer permits were actually restaurants with lunch counters.
So they had to serve food.
They had to serve food. That was part of the law, is that over 50% of their income had to come from food sales and not from alcohol sales. So that's why a lot of these first restaurants or places like the Club Cafe and Kurt's Restaurant and, believe it or not, the Ames Candy Kitchen was one of the first ones to get a beer permit. But these are your typical Main Street, a few campus town, your standard kind of lunch counter type places that you could go in and get these beers. And they would just have beer on draft, basically, back
then.
Okay. And what kind of how much of the population took advantage of this? Was it overwhelming?
Well, that's a good – on that night that they got the beer permits approved, there were beer trucks waiting in the streets to be unloaded, waiting for people to come out from the city council meeting, say, yes, it's good, I got my beer permit. And so they could get some product in and get going. And that night they got going. That was the first night that Ames had seen some alcohol-fueled nightlife in quite a while. And it was said that one restaurant had such a rush of businesses that seats were not available for thirsty patrons, and they had to stand waiting because apparently part of the law was you couldn't serve beer to someone who was standing. They had to be in one of your restaurant seats. So apparently people were just waiting for someone to finish the last little sips of their beer there so they could take their seat and get down and get a taste of legal beer for the first time themselves.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I am a transplant from Wisconsin. Mm. For some reason, Wisconsin has this I don't know what you would call it, but beer is associated with that state, and I think might be because of the Germanic and the Eastern European influence.
And the good water.
Oh, well, yes. Some say it flows all the way to Canada and God's country. But all of that aside, I know that seems to be a pretty popular drink with a lot of food.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
And there's, of course... Oktoberfest. We're in the middle of October.
We are.
And that is a huge festival for the Germanic population especially. And even if you're not, it's kind of like St. Paddy's Day. Everybody wants to be Irish.
You're a little bit German, you're a little bit Irish on
exactly.
those days, right? Yeah, and in fact, most of the, you know, especially Iowa has our largest demographic of immigration is also German. And, you know, a lot of the German people and people that had cultural ties to things like beer, you know, a lot of Germans, like, it was a beer with every meal. It was, you know, seen as a healthy type of drink because we couldn't sometimes depend on water supplies and things like that. So it really got into the German culture. And honestly, a lot of the groups that were voting for prohibition back then, most of the propaganda was about anti-whiskey, anti-things like that. It was also an anti-kind of immigrant slandering there. But most people thought beer wasn't going to go anywhere. They thought, you know, it was just like how they thought church wine and things like that weren't really going to go anywhere, which that stayed around. But people just assumed beer was not bad. It was a utility. It was like bread. It was liquid bread. And that's what a lot of posters and things you see from that era say.
So a lot of people thought of beer as the water wasn't so pure, but because of the alcohol content of beer, that purified the liquid, and that was a good substitute for drinking water.
Exactly, yep. And it lasted long. So you hear a lot about. You know, I think that's the story about why the Puritans landed at Plymouth Rock. I think they ran out of beer. Is actually what happened. They were trying to go down farther south, but they ran out of beer, so they had to pull into shore.
And stop at the local establishment?
Right,
or
exactly. Right. Start opening up a bar there. It's another thing about these beer permits, though, for some of you that have been around in town since the 60s, might remember the second prohibition that may have happened here, which would be the prohibition of campus town. So right after these beer permits went in, there was actually two beer permits that were issued in the campus town area at local eateries on Lincoln Way. But they started to get some feedback from the university and groups affiliated with the university that they still wanted to keep that little part of town isolated. So in 1942, the city council passed stricter beer permit laws, which restricted beer services only to the downtown area. They drew it out on a map. And in fact, you know, like places like the Tip Top, which we associate as one of Ames' second oldest bar, that place was actually not originally in that zone when they applied for their beer permit in the 60s. They had to get it rewritten. But so the campus town, they kind of just shut that down in the 40s. And the law was that you could not have a bar within 175 feet of any church or school property. Now, those of you that know the area around there, you know that there is, if you're standing at Lincoln Way and Welch, you have everything across the street is the university. If you go to the west, you would have had Welch Elementary School and Collegiate Presbyterian, all those churches over there, Collegiate Methodist. The other way, you have St. John's, you have St. Thomas's. If you go to the south, you have Crawford Elementary. So there isn't a very big zone in there that you can be 175 feet away.
How long was this ordinance in effect?
It was in effect until it was 25 years. So in 1966, they removed that downtown restriction. And that is when the Pizza Den got beer into campus town. And a lot of people remember the Pizza Den as being that first place to go.
I was at Iowa State at the time.
Oh, yes.
And, I knew that you had to go downtown to get a drink, and I wasn't much of a drinker, but It was part of the culture.
Definitely,
but it was,
was.
Good for those Friday afternoon discussion clubs. Well, have you got anything else to share with us on this topic, or can we fly into another topic?
I think we can fly right into the next one here.
Okay. Tell me, Alex, where are we flying here?
We're going to be flying it to, I guess, the Philippine Islands, maybe, this time around.
Okay.
So those of you, we kind of got contacted recently by a little tiny organization. You may have heard of it. It's called National Geographic, and they do some history and some nature programming in there. But National Geographic contacted us a few weeks ago because they are doing a two-hour special called the Expedition Amelia. And if you're familiar with Ballard, the gentleman who discovered the Titanic back in the 80s with his underwater equipment and crews like that, they are doing a two-hour special on his search for the lost Amelia Earhart plane, which has been probably the biggest unsolved mystery of definitely that century, if not, you know, for American history, U.S. history, all that.
At least aviation history.
Definitely.
And the fact that it was Amelia Earhart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's been over 80 years ago now that she disappeared. And so they're doing a two-hour special on that. But if you didn't know it, we have a local connection to Amelia Earhart, a young woman named Nita Snook, who moved to Ames when she was a teenager and graduated from Ames High, went to Iowa State. She bought a broken World War I airplane, surplus airplane after the war, got it shipped down here from Canada, and fixed it up in her garage down on Wilson Avenue. And her airport, I'm putting it in quotes, was the floodplain where Hilton Coliseum is. So Nita learned how to fly. She was actually the first woman to get her federal pilot's license from here in Ames, Iowa. And she later on out to California to run an airfield out there. And that is when a young Amelia Earhart and her father came in asking for pilot's lessons. And so we have this great local connection with Nita Snook, who grew up her teen years in Ames and went to college here, eventually went on to teach Amelia Earhart how to fly out in California. And so because of that, Nita saved quite a few photos of her and Amelia together when they were first taking those early pilot's license. And so National Geographic has contacted us to use some of those pictures in the upcoming documentary to tell Nita's kind of history of how she got flying and all that kind of a thing. So tune into that. It'll be on Nat Geo on Sunday, October 20th at 7 p.m. And it's a two-hour special. So if you tune in, I'm assuming probably in that first couple minutes or first little 15 minutes where they're talking about her, you'll see a little blip of a photo from our collection from Ames, Iowa here.
Well, that's great. That's great to be on. There's also another local connection there in that the Smeedalls are.
Yes.
There's a relative association there. They're relatives.
Yes.
And Karsten, I know I occasionally meet with him on a couple of issues.
Yeah, Karsten's been wonderful to us, and it's because of him that we have access to these photos in our collection, and we're able to show them off to people like National Geographic or places like Scholastic that are doing kids' reader books on Amelia, and they want to include the great fact that she was not only is she an amazing woman pilot, but was also taught by a woman, which was rare back then. So
sure.
it's a great way to reinforce that story of Amelia Earhart, and we love talking about it. But yeah, some people might remember Olav, who would be Karsten's father,
right?
Who was actually the
he was the outdoor editor,
yes,
for
the Ames Tribune.
A number of years for the Ames Trib.
Oh, long time. Yeah, he had a couple page spreads usually through the
right.
newspaper. We have some of those documents.
I have the honor of being the chair of the Olav Smeedal Conservation Award, the selection committee.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
That's we're just about ready to name an awardee for that for 2019.
Oh, great.
So we'll probably be hearing about that in one way or another.
Yeah,
so.
a great honor. Yeah. There and Olav, I believe, would be the he would have been the uncle, not the uncle. Let's see, they would be
cousins perhaps?
I believe. Yes, I have to go look at the map again, there,
or maybe a brother sister. I'm not sure. You'll have to talk to Karsten about that.
Yeah, ask Karsten if you see him around town.
Okay, is there anything else, Alex?
No, I think that's it. You got want to come in and see our History of Alcohol Uncorked exhibit? That'll be up running through going into next summer, and we're down here at 416 Douglas Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4. Come and check it out. There's a neat little speakeasy we've tucked into this exhibit where you can go in and kind of get the feel of a 1920s, 1930s speakeasy. And
so are you going to have some of that beer we were talking about?
Oh, I wish. I always, it's a tight bar, I tell you. It's only a two-seater, but I was trying to figure out how I can get one of those dorm fridges in there to keep a few cold on, but just couldn't make it work.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Local Talk. I am Mike Metz, along with Sam Wormley, your co-host for today. Thank you for listening. We had an interview with Alex Favor from the local Ames History Museum. He's the exhibit manager there, so we had the pleasure of visiting with him. And I just want to tell you that
you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org. And find links to the guests and information you heard during this program. Remember that KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try to your hand at reporting and contributing, we'll train you. Come join the Local Talk team.
Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.